Hi, everybody. This is Ramit Sethi from I Will Teach You to Be Rich. I've got Flexo from Consumerism Commentary on the line. Hi, Flexo.
Hi, Ramit. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for doing this with me.
Absolutely.
So Flexo agreed to ask his readers what questions they had for both of us. And I thought it would be fun to take those questions and both of us just try to give our own answers and see where we agree, where we disagree, and maybe where we disagree is the most fun of all.
Yeah.
So we've got some great questions from your readers, and I thought maybe I can ask one of the questions, and you can ask every other question, and then we can kind of just work our way through them and see what we both think of them. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan to me.
All right. Well, let me start with the first one, which is a great first question. If you could give one piece of advice to someone just starting out on their financial journey, what would it be?
Okay, now this is probably going to sound like something everyone has heard before, but there's a reason that everyone's heard it before. It's because I really see this as sort of the basis of everything, and I really couldn't get anywhere until I sort of internalized this myself. And it's that you have to spend less than you earn and earn more than you spend. It's really the key to getting started, because when you just get started in your financial journey or your financial career or your first job, or you're in college and you're trying to figure out what you need to do in order to survive financially in the world, you're going to find that if at the end of every month or the end of every year, money is going out more than it's coming in, there's no way for you to progress anywhere. So I really see this, even though it's been said by everyone, everywhere, every time, it really has to be sort of the basic thing that gets you started.
I like that. I like what you said about not only spending less than you make, but actually making more than you spend, because that gives you two levers to focus on. One is cutting your costs, which most people are familiar with, and in my opinion, most people are horrible at. They are very bad at being frugal. But the thing that I love is when people figure out how to earn more rather than focusing on the frugality part, which for a lot of people is excellent. For my readers that I Will Teach to Be Rich, they're never going to be frugal as much as they are going to be interested in earning more. So I like the way you put both those levers out there.
Yeah, and I have to say that, you know, when you're starting out in your first job, or, I guess I'm kind of assuming that the person asking this question is starting out, sort of at the beginning. If they're halfway through their career and they suddenly realize that they need to start, then there's, some other things we have to think about there. But for, say, the recent high school or college graduate that's just first earning money, the first money that they're earning, they really have a lot of upward room. Because probably they're not starting out earning $100,000 a year. They might be earning $30,000, $40,000, maybe less, maybe more depending on what they're doing. But they're at the beginning of the career, so there is a lot of room for growth on the earning side. So that's why I think it's really important to stress that, you could do a little as far as reducing your expenses. But if you're already struggling, you may have already reduced your expenses as much as you can. And what else are you going to do from there?
As I always like to say, you can't out-frugal your way to being rich.
Right.
My take on this question is that a year from now, you're going to be a year older. This is what my parents always told me. And their question was, what are you going to do? A year is going to pass by. And if you look back at the last year, you ask yourself, what promises did I make to myself? I was going to lose weight. I was going to save money, etc. And some of those things may have happened, some of them may have not. But looking forward, a year from now, you're going to be a year older. What I suggest is to get highly tactical. Get started right now. That's the most important thing, in my opinion. Set small goals and get quick wins. I would like for my readers to set a goal of saving $1,000 in 6 months, or in some cases, $1,000 in a month, which is that challenge I did in late 08. I want people to set goals that are ambitious, and even if they get 80% of the way there, that's great. But I think the most important thing is that there is an overwhelming amount of things you could possibly do. Once you pick one small goal and execute on it, it becomes much, much easier to do everything after that.
So what would you say about setting those goals? How does someone who's just starting out know what their goals should be?
Probably the toughest question. I don't know. I mean, to tell you the truth, I'm not necessarily the best at setting goals. A lot of times my take is just do what I think is cool and interesting, and somehow interesting things tend to come out of it. But one simple goal would be to set a dollar value of how much money you want to have in a savings account. Because I think if someone were to come to me and say, I have no idea what's going on with my money, I need one piece of advice, and then they come to me a day later and say, okay, my goal is to save money, pay off my debt, start investing, create an asset allocation, and have a Roth IRA, a 401k, and something else in 9 months. And my take is, that's impossible. You're not going to do that well. But if you say, I'm going to have $500 in my savings account or $1,000 in 3 months or 6 months, and then I'm going to learn about investing, great. I think you take it step by step. I think it's not necessarily a race, although it matters when you start. But if you are making methodical progress on it, and you can say, I've got some cash to play with now, that, to me, is a goal well set.
Yeah, that's great. I like the idea of not having too many complicated goals at the same time, especially when you're just starting out.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay.
Okay, how about this next question here?
Mm-hmm.
What should America do to ensure future generations are adequately prepared to handle money and their finances?
I find this question interesting, and this is my own personal bias being revealed, but whenever I get questions about macroeconomics or education and society as it relates to personal, as it relates to money, I instantly say to myself, I bet you this person doesn't manage their personal finances. Because in my experience, managing your own personal finance is pretty difficult, but it's much easier to read the New York Times and everyone get together and complain about what's on the front page and the economy and the president and stuff. I just, that's a trend that I've noticed. I don't know if it's a bias or not. I certainly don't know if it's true, but I don't know. I will say this. First of all, I'm first and foremost concerned with personal finance, which is very different than future generations, and it's very different than macroeconomics and the economy and the economic crisis. It's very different. With that said, to answer the question, I think the first thing that you can do is manage your own finances. That's number one. Number two, figure out how to gently help the people around you. Most people don't want to be helped with their finances, but there are some people around you, whether it's your son or your friend or your mom or dad, that can be helped. And I think from there, that at a personal level is great. On a more broader level, there have to be changes in the education system. And I think perhaps most importantly, we have to stop thinking of personal finance as a willpower game, where a lot of people think, if I just try harder, I can keep that budget. If I just try harder, I won't feel the urge to go buy those shoes. And to a certain extent, yes, there is an element of personal responsibility and we need to control ourselves more. At the same time, you know, there have been great pieces of research showing that automatically funneling money into the areas they need to go does wonders. There's a great book called Nudge, and they call this libertarian paternalism, where they opt people into behaviors that they know are going to help them, like opting into a 401k. It becomes default. People can always opt out, but what they see is that if they make it automatic, the contribution rate goes way up. It skyrockets, in some cases, to almost 100%. So I think going forward, future generations, one of the most important things besides education, which sometimes is thought of as a panacea, is to make the right behaviors automatic. That's my take. What do you think?
Actually, I was thinking along the same lines as far as behaviors, and you're talking about automation of good behaviors, and I took a different approach to this question, because although the person who asked this is asking about what America should do, I kind of took a more personal view to this and thinking, what can one person in America do to ensure that future generations that they're exposed to personally are adequately prepared? And so I was kind of taking, you know, I kind of took this as to mean, what can parents do within their own family, with their own children, to sort of encourage them to handle money properly and you know, be able to provide for themselves and their own family sometime down the road in the future. And a couple of things that I came up with is, well, like you said, encourage good habits. And one way parents can do that is, of course, by modeling good habits. And like you were saying, you can't rely on society itself to guide everyone along the correct path, because society is going to go the way it's going to go. It's going to depend on the economy and the needs of the greater society, which aren't always the same as the needs of a person trying to manage their own finances. So within a family, I would say that you'd want to model good behavior, encourage good habits with your own family, be good teachers to everyone around you. And yeah, that's kind of where I was going with that.
I like that. I think you and I agree that the first thing that people can do is manage their own finances. You know, manage it for themselves and model it well. I think you and I are 100% on the same page, because ultimately, who can you control better than anything else? You can control yourself. Okay, I got a question from a reader that I think is very interesting. I want to know your take on this one. Question is, I'd like to hear your thoughts on dating. I know many of us guys are tempted to take a girl out to fancy dinners and buy expensive gifts, but what are some ideas you have about frugal dating? I guess a lot of it depends on the girl's personality and if she's comfortable just staying in and cooking dinner, for example. What frugal dates have you been on? Any success stories? All right. What do you think?
I love this question. This question is great. Well, lately my dates have been pretty frugal. My girlfriend and I have been together for some time now, so we've gotten past the idea where we feel we have to impress each other with you know, fancy activities and expensive vacations and all that kind of stuff. Which is, I mean, in today's society, that's all part of, you know, courting, finding the person that you want to be with. But when it comes to casual dating, I think it's really an opportunity to find someone who's compatible with your views on life and specifically on money. Like the person asking this question says, a lot of it depends on the girl's personality, if she's comfortable just staying in. And you might find that after, you know, you probably want to date a number of people so that you can sort of get an idea for the kind of person you're looking for. And you'll probably find that there are some people with some views on money that just feel compatible. And you might be turned off by people with other views on money. And dating really gives you a chance to sort of find that out for yourself. So a lot of the things that I've liked to do lately are just like you said, eating in, cooking, even though I consider myself a terrible cook. My girlfriend has managed to stay with me so far. So I guess we managed to work it out somehow.
So I think, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and when we go on vacation, we try to reduce our expenses, maybe stay with family if we can, or just try different things that are more interesting, but maybe not, you know, sort of the typical vacations that other people might be inclined to do, like they go to Mexico or Cabo San Lucas or something like that. No, we just sort of take it easy. But that's because, you know, we've grown to know each other over the past couple of years, and we're a lot more comfortable with what we like to do. At the beginning, it might be a little different as you sort of search around and try to find what works for each other.
I think everyone's going to want to know, how old are you?
I'm 33 years old.
Okay, great. And I'm 26. So this is a great question. I really like this, although I'm a little puzzled. Why ask us? I mean, why ask a couple of personal finance bloggers? It's so weird. I think this takes me dangerously close to that, I think it's called the halo effect, where people who write on one thing, they start talking about everything else, and they start recommending computer monitors to buy and hubcaps to buy. I will say this. I'm going to stay, you know, I could give you a list of 10 ways to save money on frugal dates. But, like, why would you listen to me? It's irrelevant. I think from my perspective, my take is this. If going on dates to expensive restaurants is something that you value, then you should spend extravagantly on it. And what I would urge you is think about it. Is it something valuable to you? And then most people just stop there. They're like, yes, I really like expensive restaurants. Well, that's great. I value your opinion, but you have to go one step further, which is look at your conscious spending plan or look at where your money's going and how it's being routed and say, okay, knowing that I will have to cut back on something in order to pay for these expensive dinners, or I'm going to have to earn more, put in context, is eating at fancy restaurants still valuable to me? And if it is, then you should find a way to find the money for it. If it's not, then you should, you know, go find plenty of ways to save money. My take is that you have to think about it consciously. And a lot of people, they kind of spend money and then they look back a month and they shrug and say, ah, I guess I spent that much. But decide for yourself. Don't feel guilty. If you want to go out to a $50 dinner or a $100 dinner, or in one of my friend's cases, this guy, I'm not kidding, he will never spend money on cabs in San Francisco. But when he goes on dates, he goes out to these dinners that cost $250. And we find it utterly bizarre. But he is indeed spending consciously because that's what he values. And he finds the money to do that, but he cuts costs mercilessly on things like cabs that he doesn't care about. So I think from my perspective, I really don't have any advice that other people couldn't offer you, probably better advice on saving money on dates. But I will encourage you to think consciously about, do you actually value this? And if so, don't feel guilty. Spend on it. But if you don't value it, then there are plenty of ways to save money on it. And, you know, you can spend your money elsewhere.
Yeah, that's great advice. I have to say, I really like the idea of prioritizing and deciding how important certain expenses are to you. And, you know, when you're dating, you're probably going to want to find someone who has sort of similar priorities.
Isn't that interesting? Let's take a little detour because I've been having a discussion with my friends, and I'm really curious to hear what you think about this.
Okay.
So we've been talking about, would you marry someone who is in debt, okay? And of course, this came up because, especially for me, my friends were like, oh, Mr. Personal Finance Blogger, what do you think, right? And so my take was that there are two parts to the question, and I'm really curious what you think. So the first part is, like, how much is the debt, right? If it's $1,000, that's certainly manageable. If it's $70,000, that's a different story. And then beyond that, and I think maybe more importantly, like, why? Why did they get in this debt? And that's almost more influential or impactful than the amount itself, because it's like, okay, does this mean they don't have control? Does this mean they make poor decisions? Does this mean they don't have the capacity to earn an income? Like, what is it about them that got them into that much debt? And, you know, certainly, you know, maybe someone could pay off $5,000 of debt, but then they get married and they go right back to it. Or, you know, are there other extenuating circumstances? I don't know. So my take is, like, never say never. So I really have no answer to it. But those are just the things that I thought about. What do you think about in terms of, you know, would you marry someone who is in debt?
Well, I would, because that's the wrong question. The question you should be asking isn't how much debt are they in, but, you know, what are their attitudes towards money? Why are they in debt? Is it something that everyone is working on together about, or is it a bad attitude towards money that has caused this? I mean, there are so many other questions that are involved here. You can't just look at a number and make a decision about, you know, I can't marry you because you have $100,000 in debt because you've just gotten out of med school and you have student loans to pay back and you have a great job and you're paying off that debt. But since you have $100,000 of it, you know, if it was $95,000, yeah, I think we could do it. But $100,000, no way.
Right.
I just couldn't set, you know, it has nothing to do with the dollar amount. It has to do with personality, attitude, and approach.
It's funny because what you said is a great response for so many questions that I get through my blog. People saying, you know, how much does it take to be rich? What kind of income can I make as a management consultant? And what people are looking for is the answer. In fact, when I used to be in high school, I remember there were people a couple grades above me who got into Stanford where I wanted to go. And I asked them, like, what SAT score did it take? I was looking for a number. I was looking for the silver bullet. And they would always give me these things that I thought of as platitudes, like, oh, you really have to create an interesting narrative, and you have to, yes, you have to do well on your test, but there's more to it than that. And I kind of just thought, oh, that's BS. But I find myself doing the same thing, which is mirroring exactly what you just said, saying, it's really not about a number. It's about something much deeper than that, attitudes, behaviors, the way that they handle stress and money, rather than just, you know, 85,000, that's my limit. Well, let's go on to the next question.
Okay, let me ask that one to you then.
Okay.
What is one... Okay, I'm trying to find the right one here, sorry. At what point does one know that he or she is saving too much? Put another way, what factors should somebody look at to ensure that they aren't sacrificing their happiness in the present by saving too much for the future?
Probably one of the more rare questions that you and I get. So I've written a couple things on this. One, in the book, it's a box that's called When Do I Get to Spend This Money? And then in the book and on my blog as well, there's an article called There's a Difference Between Cheap and Frugal. I think that, first of all, society will push you to spend more as you get older. So it's great to start off on the frugal side. I think that's great. A lot of people start off spending money extravagantly young, maybe because their parents set a model, and it's very hard to go back. There's great research in the psychology world by Cialdini and a bunch of other people showing that we are more motivated by loss than by gain. So I would say it's very important to slowly add things to your life because it's very difficult to take them away. Coming back to the question, my question is really, are you hitting your goals? And those goals are not just financial, but social as well. You know, are you seeing your family? Are you flying out to visit your friends as often as you want? Are you taking a vacation or you know, going to classes, whatever you want to do? If you find that you're doing those things and you're hitting all your goals, or in other words, you're doing what you want to do and you're happy, then I think it's great. Personal finance is not always about, you know, making 50 changes in your life. Sometimes it's just about being happy and being rich. And like I always emphasize, money is just a small part of that. I will say that I've set up some rules for myself. So when I earn unexpected income, I force myself to spend a pretty big percentage of that. I think it's 50% within the first month. And what that does for me is it helps me force myself to take risks and to make unusual revenue from different sources that I normally wouldn't do. That forces me to not just save it, but actually use it, because money is meant to be used. But in general, I think this is a good problem to have. If you're worried about saving too much, you can look at it mathematically, you know, put your numbers into a calculator. But I think there's actually a lot more going on here than just the numbers. I think it's really about what do you want out of life. And if you're getting that, then you should feel good about yourself. What do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I like what you were saying about starting off frugal, or at least more towards the frugal end of the spectrum, because the more you can save now, the more later on you'll have a variety of choices, you'll have more options, and you'll have more things you can do with that saved money later on. And overall, just finding balance between happiness and saving for the future, balance between the present and the future, it's a very personal kind of decision that you have to make. I mean, first, you do kind of have to understand that you are going to have expenses in the future that you have to start saving for now. So you can't just go searching out for gratification immediately. I guess for me, it's all about empathy, because as humans, we try to have empathy for other people and understand what other people are going through. And when we see people, it's easy to do that. But the person we can't see is the person that we are going to be in the future. So it's a lot harder to have empathy for the person who you're going to be in the future. You want to sort of think about who you are going to be and what are going to be your needs at that point. And once you've started to think about that, you'll be able to see, you know, what that leaves you with in order to use at this time to sort of find your happiness and spend what you want to spend and do what you want to do and go on those vacations and have those parties and, you know, go out to the bar and buy drinks every night. If you have room to do that while you're still thinking about the person who you're going to be in the future and having empathy for that person.
I agree. I totally agree. All right. This one cuts to the core. Well, the thing about these questions is that a lot of times people like to ask us, like, what we are doing wrong, which is a perfectly valid question. But I would just prefer to talk about what other people are doing wrong. Okay, so this question is, what is one financial move you made when you were younger that you most regret?
Okay, well, I have no problem talking about the mistakes I've made because I'm always happy to share and make a fool out of myself. I ignored my finances for several years after I was, you know, while I was in college and after I was out of college for a few years. And I didn't realize this at the time, or maybe I did and I was just keeping myself ignorant of it, but what I was doing was actually choosing to ignore my finances. I wasn't just ignoring them, but I was making a conscious decision every day to ignore them, even if it was, you know, maybe not fully conscious, but it was definitely a choice. When I got out of college, I was working for a nonprofit organization, which is great. It was a cause that I was really into. I thought it was one of the best things I could do with my talents and with my time and with my effort. And I was working a whole lot. And in order to do this, in order to work for this cause that I really cared about, I made some sacrifices on the income side. Yeah, I wasn't making a lot of money there at all, which is okay, and that's a sacrifice that people often make when they're working for something that they care about deeply. The problem I was having was I wasn't really making the same sacrifices on the expense side. So my income was down, but I wasn't living as if my income was down. I mean, I wasn't extravagant, but I was definitely not looking at my money, you know, even on a month-to-month basis to try to figure out what I was going to be able to afford to do. I just assumed I was able to afford whatever I wanted. So, you know, I started to realize this after a few years of not really having money. And I started giving in and making some more sacrifices, like moving closer to the office, in a bad neighborhood, found a stranger for a roommate over the internet, which was, you know, it was a good idea to save some money, but there were some other problems with that. Okay. But even with doing all of this kind of sacrifice, I still wasn't coming out ahead. And it really took a wake-up call for me to sort of get my life into gear after that. And I was sort of forced to making some changes. At that point, I just kind of realized that, you know, I have to be more conscious about everything that I do. So that's I really regret not, from the start, making the sacrifices that I needed to make in order to make the job that I wanted to have viable.
Yeah, that makes sense. But like, what kind of sacrifices?
Well, on the expense side, the sacrifices that I probably needed to make were my living situation, first of all. I mean, I never really wanted to have a roommate. I prefer to live by myself, but that really wasn't working out. I wanted to live near my friends too. My friends all lived in one area of New Jersey, but my job was about 2 hours away. And you know, the people at work were saying, "Well, you should just move closer to the office. You're here all the time anyway." And I was really resisting it because, well, I didn't really like the area so much. But you know what? You know, sometimes you just have to suck it up and deal with it. And I really didn't do that until it was too late.
That reminds – that's a great story. I mean, I find it interesting that you thought about it so much, because I would say that a lot of my friends, they don't think about it as much. They don't consciously decide often what they're doing. It's kind of just – it just happens. And I'm still watching, you know, a lot of my friends are in their mid-20s, and that turning point hasn't necessarily come. And, if, you know, for some people it comes and for some not. What I found in the research, typically around in the 40s, people really change their financial behavior. Of course, mm-hmm. by that point, it's often pretty late. You can't catch up on the compounding gains. But I find it really interesting when there are turning points. I know I worked at a startup that was designed to sell things on eBay. So kind of like you drop it off, we sell it on eBay. And what they found in their market research was that there were like 7 crisis points that people would come to them and try to sell stuff. Divorce, death in the family, that's very morbid, mm-hmm. birth in the family, something like that. And it seems also that there are big turning points in people's financial lives. I just haven't been able to figure them out yet.
Well, for me, it probably was the loss of the job. Mm. I ended up losing that job after, you know, making the sacrifices that I eventually had to make. It just didn't work out in the end. And so that really helped push me along and get myself into gear.
Great. Well, probably a valuable lesson.
Yeah, absolutely.
My take on it is in terms of the thing I most regret is really not starting to invest early enough. I started learning about personal finance when I was right after high school in college. I really got serious about it. But even though I was learning it, I didn't necessarily start investing. And I think about like the internships I had during college. And some of them I earned a lot of money, or I did consulting during the year. And I, you know, really had nothing to show for it. I would kind of just spend it. And I did end up saving, you know, some amount of money in college. But I look back and say, wow, if I had put that to work, it really would have grown for me. So I think big regret is just not starting early and starting to invest consistently. My younger brother actually started investing, I think, like 10 years before I did. So he's got a big leg up, which is great.
Wow, so he must have been pretty much like a teenager when
yeah.
he started. Right?
He couldn't even open his own Roth IRA. It had to be a custodial account.
Wow, that's great. That's great for him.
Yeah, good for him. Yeah. So what's the next question here?
Okay, so what's a personal finance topic where you don't practice what you preach?
Good question. Well, first of all, about 3 years ago, 3 to 5 years ago, it would have been not keeping a budget. But because I don't keep a budget, and after reading the research and just talking to my friends, what I discovered is that nobody keeps a budget. We all say we keep a budget. We all say we should keep a budget, but we don't, for the vast majority of us. So I stopped keeping a budget because I said, this is not going to work. I can't fight against my own nature. And instead, what I adopted was like a conscious spending plan and automation. But one of those things that I talk about is focusing on the one or two areas where you can cut your costs dramatically. And what I try to target is the top 2 discretionary areas, cutting those costs by 25 to 33% over a period of about 6 months. For example, if I spend $600 on eating out per month, I might try to get that to $400 over a period of 6 months. And what that does is it generates like $200 a month in cash flow, which I can use, I can reroute to travel or investing or anything. Well, the thing is, I don't always cut it as consistently as I set my goals out to be. Mm. So I will say, all right, after evaluating my last 3 months of spending, my average spending is $600 a month. So I want to get down to $400 by blah, blah date. Sometimes that just doesn't happen. Sometimes it actually goes up. And I think I've got this weird thing in my head that's like, yeah, costs are important, but I'd rather just make more instead of having to affect my lifestyle. And that can be good because it can drive you to be very entrepreneurial. But at the same time, you really have to keep your costs in check. So I think, you know, if there are one area where I'm not practicing what I preach as much as I should, it really is focusing on those 2 discretionary areas and cutting them consistently. That's my take.
Okay. I mean, my thoughts are kind of similar to this because I was thinking along the same lines when it comes to the budget, because I've written a lot about budgeting. But I've also freely admitted that, you know, budgeting it's good to a point, but you know, some people are going to have problems with budgeting, and I'm one of those people. The way most people look at a budget is that it's just this kind of inflexible kind of rules that you have to stick to. But I really don't feel that that works for me, and I think it doesn't work for a lot of people. So when I talk about budgeting, I try to turn it into sort of a more flexible, changeable, malleable set of ideas rather than this month I have to spend $200 on food, this month I have to spend no more than $100 on clothing. Because, you know, month to month, some things vary, and you really need to take a more holistic look at that. So even though I've talked a lot about budgeting, but that's one thing where I really probably don't I'm not as diligent on that for my own personal finances. And a lot of that also has to do with the fact that I think budgeting is more important, or it's more necessary when your level of income and expenses are close, and your expenses are butting up onto your level of income. Because it's at that point where you really need to be probably a little more strict and stick to a spending plan. But, you know, just as you found, Ramit, when your income is higher than your expenses, you have a lot more room to play with from month to month.
Yeah.
But you can do that, but you still have to think about, like we were saying before, think about, you know, what you're going to need in the future.
Speaking of budgets, this next question starts off with this sentence that makes me, we just talked about how I personally don't like budgets mm-hmm. as well, but this is a question about a budget, so let's take it. I'd like to ask about putting together a real workable budget. Sure, you can analyze your spending for months and figure out ways to cut costs, but I always seem to end up doing a lot of guessing. That's very true. How can mm-hmm. we discover what is reasonable? For example, what is a reasonably frugal grocery budget for a family of three? What's a reasonable amount of money to save for car repairs or other occasional expenses? And how much is a reasonable amount to spend on clothing? Okay. What do you think?
Well, this is another question where, you know, we're looking for some for hard numbers, and hard numbers are difficult to give. I mean, the individual who asked this question is saying they're doing a lot of guessing, and guessing is what you're going to do. There's no problem with guessing. It's good to guess. It's especially if you have looked at your spending for a month or two. That's really all you need, a month or two. You don't have to really spend, you know, a long time analyzing everything. You just have to get a good idea of what's going on with your money before you can really set up, you know, sort of, you know, loose guidelines for what you want to spend. So when you're guessing based on reasonable data. So your guesses aren't just going to be numbers pulled out of the air. So that's really where you want to head when you're making this budget. But as far as a reasonable frugal grocery budget, it's hard to say because it depends on the kind of food you need to buy, and it depends on how many people you're buying for. It depends on where you live in the country or the world. It depends on what your dietary needs are. I don't think I can really pin down a specific number, but maybe that's because, you know, I don't have experience with a family of three. I have experience with a family of me plus a cat. So I can tell you really what's reasonable for myself and Rupert, but that's, you know, I can make some guesses, but your guesses are going to be better than mine because you've been looking at your own spending, and you can probably pick out certain things where you can pull back if you need to. I mean, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I thought what you said is interesting. This person is clearly intelligent. They clearly know that you are not going to be able to guess where they live or guess, you know, their grocery budget. So why do you think they ask this question? What are they really looking for?
Yeah, they're probably looking for some, what do you call that? Validation that what they're doing is okay. At least, you know, maybe that's what I think, but what do you think?
Well, okay, look, I agree. You can't give specific numbers for this person. I do have some numbers from my book. In my conscious spending chapter on page 104, I propose a high-level categories of spending. And I'll just walk you through it. This is typically for someone who's 20 to 35 years old. So it definitely will be different if you have children. I want to say that up front. For fixed costs, including rent, utilities, debt, 50 to 60% of your take-home pay. For your investments, like your 401k and your Roth IRA, 10%. For your savings, those are typically things that you're going to spend in the next 5 years or so. Plus, of course, your emergency budget. That's about 5 to 10% of your take-home. And then your guilt-free spending money, going out, going to bars, movies, clothes, that's 20 to 35% of your take-home. So as you can imagine, that 20 to 35% probably goes way down when you have children. I will say this. I think that this is an interesting question because, you know, clearly they're intelligent and they're not necessarily looking for the numbers. What I would recommend is using a technique I call the think, want, do technique. So on three pieces of paper, just create three tables that are identical. On the left side, they just have the categories of expenses you have, you know, food, clothes, whatever. The first page, call it your think page. What percentage of your take-home income do you think you're spending in each category? How much do you think you're spending on food? You know, most people, whatever they say, let's say 25%. Okay. In the next page, I want you to, instead of doing what you think, I want you to put what you want to spend. So you want 20% instead of 25% spent on food. And then finally, the third one is the do. What are you actually doing? How much are you actually spending? And what I would say is that I guess I disagree with you a little bit, Flexo, is that guessing is okay at the beginning, but it's not really okay forever. I think of when you're looking at your own expenses, which is a very important part. It's probably the hardest part of anything I talk about. That's not asset allocation and rebalancing and diversification and blah, 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 taxes. It's really about figuring out what you're spending your own money on. What I will say, though, is that like it's okay to start off guessing, but you should quickly peel that onion to get to the core and figure out after a period of 2 to 3 months, you will know exactly how much you're spending to a very accurate degree. Once you know that, you've got your third part, your due, and then you can quickly reroute money from one area to the other. In general, I think you've got all the data you need. It's just a matter of putting it together. So one way to do that would be the think, want, do technique.
That sounds like a really interesting technique. I'll have to try that for myself.
Let me know. If you do it, I'll be very interested.
No, yeah, I will definitely do that. You know, maybe it's not such a bad idea to take this approach here. There's a tool out there now on the internet called Mint. You can go there at mint.com. And one of the features they have there is this sort of it's a demographic spending tool. And you can kind of use that to you sort of plug in or tell the site a little bit about yourself, you know, what your income is, how many people are in your family, and the kind of expenses that you have. And what they'll do is I believe, last time I looked, I believe it had this feature, but you can actually look and see what other people like you are spending now. I mean, that might not be terribly accurate, and it could be a reflection of what people are spending when they shouldn't be spending as much as they are, but at least it will give you sort of an idea of what's going on in the world in which people are sharing, hopefully truthfully, a little bit more about their expenses. So you can sort of compare yourself to what's going on.
That's a great idea. That's probably the first thing I would do. Boy, I'm glad you brought that up. That is a great feature that Mint has, so I would definitely encourage them to do that as well. That's a great tip. Let me ask you this next question. I'd like to ask about the role of faith or values when it comes to spending. For example, I'd like to purchase locally produced, sustainably grown food. However, it's cost prohibitive. I'd like to send my daughter to a school which will infuse her with values of sustainability. It's cost prohibitive. I would like to be sure that my home is energy efficient using a minimum of non-renewable resources. This, too, is cost prohibitive. How can we balance sustainability with the luxury of living more sustainably? What do you think?
Wow, this is a great question. I think, well, first of all, that you do, when your income is limited, you do have to go back and prioritize, like we were talking about before. I mean, living sustainably, at least the way sustainability is sort of, you know, in the American sense of the word, is it is expensive because locally grown food is going to be more expensive than mass produced food. So you basically have to decide if your income is limited, how important are these specific ways of expressing your values are important, because you can have values about sustainability without putting yourself into the poorhouse. I mean, it is possible, but you will have to make decisions about where you can infuse those values and where, well, you're going to have to just get by for now. And, you know, as things improve with your own finances, or as the world sort of shifts towards a more an environment, sort of a world where we're more focused on the environment, which hopefully is the way we're heading right now. You'll find that as you're dealing more with renewable resources, they're all going to become less expensive in the future, hopefully, as long as that becomes more widely developed and accepted and adopted throughout the world. So you make some sacrifices now if you have to, and then eventually you'll be able, as long as you're continuing to infuse these ideas into your children, they'll all be interested in continuing this sort of lifestyle as it's more available to you. Now, as far as the question also asked about sending the person's daughter to a school which will infuse her with these values. And a lot of times, too, that's going to be difficult if cost is an issue, because if you believe that a private school is more in tune with the values that you want to pass on to your children, then that's something you're going to have to pay for in many cases. When it comes down to that, I think it's important to sort of take what you can from the schools that you can afford without putting your family in danger or of survival, and really reinforce those values that are important to you at home, so they can understand what goes on in the world and your approach and how things might be different for your family. And I think it can work without having to, you know, find the highest priced school that matches your values in the country.
Yeah. One of the things I did I had a pre-launch community for my book, and somebody said something like, "I can't afford a financial advisor." I think that was what they said. And that really got me mad, because if there's one thing I don't ever want to hear from people, especially the people who buy my book, is that I can't afford something. You can always afford something. It's a matter of setting up a savings goal and figuring out if it really is a priority to you. And the question is, yeah, it might take you a month to afford it, or it might take you 6 years to afford it. But if it's important, and if you can motivate yourself to save for it, you will afford it at some point. 99% of things. You know, if you're going to try to buy a castle, that may not be reasonable. So the thing I would say about this question is, you can certainly go with values. You can apply your values. The thing is, just start off slow. Don't try to do it all at once. You could buy, you know, one organic thing at first. And then at the same time, you try to balance off your budget and say, what can I cut? Or can I earn a little bit more to make up for that? Then you can buy two. Maybe you decide that, for one of your recreational activities, you're going to go learn about, I don't know, sustainably grown food. And at the end of that, you get, I don't know, a basket of eggs, right? I'm just making up an example here, but blending your recreation with these sustainable goals is another way. On a tactical level, let's say that you want to send your daughter to school, or you want to buy an energy efficient air conditioner, okay? That costs $3,000. Fine. So what I would do there is set up a savings goal. I would create a sub-savings account in my savings account. I use ING Direct. You can use whatever you want. And each month, I would automatically transfer some amount of money from my checking account right to that sub-savings account. And it will grow faster than you believe. I do this for a lot of things. I create a sub-savings account for vacation. I create it for stupid mistakes that I know I'm going to make. And I put it away for Christmas gifts. There's a bunch of stuff that I automatically save for. So creating that, making it automatic, yeah, you may not be able to get that air conditioner today, tomorrow, or until next year. But you put away a little amount of money, and you really have two levers. You have time and you have amount. If you want to save $1,500 a month, you can get it in 2 months. If you want to save $100 a month, it's going to take you a little bit longer. But it's just simple numbers. You can save for it. So I would just say it's not something that you have to do immediately. You can start your value. You can execute your values and just do it in a smaller level than you think.
Yeah, that's a good plan. And I think it's important to think about the fact that just because you're not at the point where you're living your values the way you want to live it immediately, that somehow you're being untruthful to who you really are. I think you really have to be realistic where you have to be, and you can keep those values, and don't feel like you're lying to yourself when you have to make sacrifices in order to reach the way you want to execute those values later on.
Well, isn't it funny? This is a thing that I've noticed about a lot of my friends, which is, you know, most of them have not bought houses because, a lot of them live in New York or the Bay Area, and it's really expensive. But the funny thing is, when they talk about buying houses, the things that they talk about are like, I mean, it's like our parents' houses, and they're like fully furnished. They want a fireplace. They want all this and that, dual showers, whatever. And I'm thinking, man, have you seen some of the houses that people buy in the Bay Area in their 30s? Like, they are not what you're thinking. And it occurred to me that we want everything our parents have because that's what we know. But our parents worked for 20, 30, 40 years to be able to get that. So you may want to have, you know, all these values played out through your finances, but you may also just have to wait and be patient as well. Because our parents did that, and I think, I can speak for myself. Boy, I'm very, very impatient. I want things now, but I think it's understanding that we do have to wait a little bit sometimes to get what we really want.
Yeah, I know I'm waiting too. So, I was lucky. I mean, I don't own a house either. I rent. And yes, I'm 33 years old and I still rent, and I'm quite fine with that. And I'm saving money for doing so, and I'm able to invest at the same time I'm saving up for a house at some point when I decide it's time for me to settle down and get a house. But it took me a long time to get at least to the apartment that I wanted, the kind of apartment that I wanted. I had to, like I was saying before, suck it up and live with roommates. Some horrible roommates early on. And eventually I was able to live with friends, so that was a step up. And after a while, after a long time of doing that and saving money and finding ways to increase my income too, which was important, I was able to at least find an apartment that I liked well enough to stay for a while.
Yep. All right, what do we got on the next question?
Oh, yeah, I really want to ask this question to you. Okay, you use the term rich, a word that carries many different connotations. How does one know when he or she is rich? Can it be measured objectively? If so, how? Or if it is a subjective state of mind, how would you describe it?
People think of rich in a very specific way. It's a very loaded word. But if you dig in by asking even one or two questions, all of their assumptions fall apart. You ask someone, are you rich? And they can say yes or no. And what does that actually tell you? If you earn $100,000, does that make you rich? Maybe. Maybe in certain cities, but in Manhattan, you're not rich. Okay? Does it mean owning a Mercedes makes you rich? Maybe. Maybe not. Did you buy it or did you get it as a gift? Or an inheritance. Rich, in my opinion, only a small part of it is about money. Money certainly contributes to being rich. but you define rich to be what you want. For me, and I've defined it explicitly in the book and on my blog, it is about being able to travel where I want, when I want. It's about being able to work on the things that interest me, turn down job offers that I don't want, even though they may be well-paying offers. It's the ability to go fly, visit my friends for a weekend, and then come back home because I want to. And it's about also, you know, starting a scholarship and helping others out entrepreneurially. That's for me. For other people, it would be totally different. And I think it's important to acknowledge that some people have really different values of being rich. Some people want to buy $300 jeans and $700 handbags and a $65,000 Mercedes, and that is fine. But oftentimes people don't like that. They have their own definition, and they don't want other people. It's not okay for people to be rich in a certain way. But in my opinion, you define what rich means to you, and then you work to achieve it. I will say that I think it's important to talk about it with other people. What does rich mean to you? Asking your friends. I rarely get discussions about that, even though I have a blog called I Will Teach You to Be Rich, ironically. But I will say that you don't get rich just sitting in a room. Rich is not only determined by you, but by the people and things around you. So I do think that if you, me, and 10 of our readers sat in a room, we would all have very different definitions. Can it be measured objectively? Maybe. If your definition is that you have $1 million, then I guess it could. But in my opinion, for my definition, no. So I guess I would say, it's important to think about what being rich is. It's important, more important, to execute on that. But I will just say that it's very different for different people. And in my opinion, money is a small part of being rich. What do you think?
Oh, definitely money is a small part of being rich. But a lot of people don't see it that way. And a lot of people are focused on the money itself. And that's kind of what we're brought, the culture that we're brought up into, at least the one that I've brought up into, is a lot like that, because you watch a lot of television shows and you experience life outside your house, and you see people who spend money, and they look like they're having fun and they're happy, and they're doing all the things that you would think that rich people do, like driving fancy cars, live in huge houses, and this is sort of what we're exposed to and what we're kind of taught to expect as far as what rich is. But I think we have to stop looking outside of ourselves to determine what rich is. It's more of an internal state of being. For me, it has to do with flexibility. I mean, am I going to be able to, one, not worry or be stressed about my financial condition? The more things that we can put on autopilot, as long as everything is working well, that's one aspect of being rich. Another one is being able to, provide for the endeavors that are important to me. Like, I like to be involved in the arts, and I would like to, sort of be able to provide for arts related organizations as I can. And for me, in order to be rich, I would have to be at a position where I can sort of do that without having to worry about, the finances of my own family. So that's kind of where it would be for me personally. And for you, too, you'd have to decide exactly what it would mean to you to be rich.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, deciding is one thing, but, like, there are a lot of people, especially people who are, like, somewhat intermediate in personal finance. I mean, they've been reading blogs, and they know what's up. And they say, for me, rich is when I have a crossover point where my investments earn more than, I do working. Okay, good. That is excellent. That's step one. So how are you going to get there, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have a plan for funneling in tons and tons of cash into your investment system so that it grows? Or are you planning to, you know, get a second job? What are you planning to do? Like, being rich is great at a strategy level, but then the question is, like, how are you going to do it? Not what is rich, but then the next question is, how are you going to get there? So, you know, if you say, I want to take one big trip every year, and, you know, that those trips, let's say they cost $3,000. Okay, that's a great definition for rich. How are you going to do that? And I think, you know, that brings it back to the tactical level. Let's go on to this next question, which is one about student loans. Do you get student loan questions a lot on your site?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, me too. This one is, I'm a veterinarian that recently graduated with $130,000 in student loans. What should be my top priority, paying off the loans or saving up money for a house? Or should I devote 50% of my available funds to both endeavors at the same time?
Well, I'm always a fan of trying to use your money towards whatever is most important to you. So that's, you know, again, prioritizing. But I mean, there's a strict, if you look at this purely from a number standpoint, there's one answer. And if you're dealing with more of, you know, what's important to you, you'll find that sometimes that doesn't always work perfectly with the numbers. I mean, you can't go wrong by doing something. You can't go wrong by putting your money to the student loans and to savings so that you can afford to buy a house when you're ready. $130,000, you know, as far as student loans go, yes, that's a lot of money. Student loans, however, as far as debt goes, I mean, you could do a lot worse. Your interest rates are probably low, so you can probably stretch out the payments if getting a house is so important to you that you want to really focus on that now. But yet, you know, the feeling of being debt-free is important. If that's something that's important to you, then you'll want to speed up paying off those loans. I mean, if you're, depending on your income level, you might be able to write off some of the interest on the student loans. So that's always a good plus, but it shouldn't be the main focus of what you're doing. I mean, like some of the other questions we have here, I know you're looking for a sort of a concrete answer in what to do. And, you know, I always shy away from giving concrete answers because there's so much more to money than just the numbers. I mean, there's a strictly numbers answer that I can give you. We plug in all of your numbers into a calculator, tell you what the best option is to do.
Which calculator should they go to?
There's a website called Dinkytown. I think it's dinkytown.net. They have a wide variety of calculators. I know there's one for evaluating student loans. You know, I can't be more specific than that, but you'll probably want to take a look there and play with the numbers and see what you can figure out and what's going to cost you less money in the long run. I mean, with student loans, the reason that interest rates on student loans are so low is because, you know, the society encourages getting education that's going to help you earn money down the road and contribute to the economy. So there's nothing wrong with taking the approach of stretching those loans out while you're doing more important things with your money. There's so much flexibility in student loans that you can really do that. But still, it's a personal choice as far as the relief of being free of that debt. And, you know, it's a lot depends on your income and how much extra money you have to put towards these goals.
My take on this is, first of all, I find the question a little curious because the two choices are paying off the loans or saving up money for a house. What's with that? Why are those the two choices? What's the reason for buying a house? I don't know where this person lives, but in some areas it makes good sense to buy a house if the price to rent or buy is similar. In some areas, like on the coast, it generally, financially speaking, doesn't make sense. So why buy a house? What are the reasons for that? A lot, and the reason I ask this, and I want to drill into this for a second, is that there is a culture in America of home ownership, a mistaken culture of home ownership, that everyone, that buying a house is a great investment and that we all should buy a house and that it's the next step. And this in itself could be another hour-long discussion, but I'll try to keep it short. as investing goes, buying a house generally is not a good investment. And there's great research indicating that, you know, over since 1890, that net-net investing returns on buying a house are close to zero. People find that really surprising because since birth, their parents have been talking about the white picket fence. And the government explicitly encourages home ownership through tax benefits. The problem, of course, is that it's actually a cognitive problem. People will buy a house for $200,000. 20 years later, they'll sell it for $400,000, and they'll think, wow, I made 200 grand. I doubled my money. Great. Well, first of all, no, you didn't, because you forget about the 6% you paid on the broker fee. You forget about the repairs that you wouldn't have had to do as a renter. You forget about you know, all kinds of inflation and other factors that factor in. The other thing is that if you have a house that's renting for $1,000 a month and the mortgage is $1,000 a month, people forget. They think, oh, I'll get the mortgage, I'll get the tax deduction. You forget that it actually costs typically 25 to 45% more on the mortgage because people have to pay for taxes, maintenance, and all kinds of fees that you don't have to pay for as a renter. So with that said, I just want you to think carefully about how much will this house actually cost you. There's a great calculator, the New York Times buy versus rent calculator. You should definitely look at that. You should also add a third option to it, which is investing. Well, why not, you know, look at your 401k or your Roth IRA, certainly. In fact, if I were you, you want to think about your Roth IRA because you can contribute, depending if you're a couple or not. Actually, you make too much for a Roth IRA, but there are other options for you where you can contribute and you can actually take that money out for a first-time home purchase. So, Flexo, I agree with you because I actually wrote an article that said exactly what you just talked about. It was called The Best Decision Versus the Financially Smart One. For some people, they hate having debt and they just want to pay it off. But, you know, for other people, you may want to run the numbers and say, hey, I'm going to save $40,000 doing it this way. In my book, I actually talk about this question in detail on page 35. So you can kind of figure out how you go about calculating what makes sense. And then also, it's not just the math, it's also the emotion. And you can figure out how you feel about doing one versus the other.
I really like what you said about the real cost of owning a house. I think that's something that people don't consider. Like you said, they'll buy the house for $200,000, sell it for $400,000, think, wow, I had a great increase in price there over a couple of years. And yeah, how can you beat that with any other investment? Well, you know, you have to look at every single expense that went into operating that house. And although, you know, it's when the government will tell you that's not part of the cost basis, you know, when you have to report your profit on your the house that you sold, but it really is, because that's all money that goes into the cost of owning a house. And yeah, that you mentioned, Ramit, that houses don't actually earn money over long periods of time. That you're exactly right. It turns out that real estate is basically just over inflation. That's the best you can get, and which is basically like not earning much of anything on real estate at all. So try not to look at the house as an investment. A house is a place where you live in. It's something that you need to live somewhere, whether it's a house or it's an apartment that you rent. And if you can have a better deal renting, then that might be the better option. You know, it all depends on what's important to you.
Yep, I agree. I think I get to write more about this because I find it very interesting. If anyone is curious about learning more about some of the real estate links I've collected, you can check out delicious.com/Ramit Sethi. That's RAMITSETHI /real estate. And there's a dash between the real and the estate. So delicious.com/Ramit Sethi/real-estate.
And you'll probably have a link there to that rent versus buy calculator at the New York Times,
That's
right?
That's correct. Yep, definitely. What do we have? Is this, you want to ask this one?
Yeah, I'll ask this to you. Okay, this is another numbers question here. Here's my situation. I am 13 years into a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage at 6%. I refinanced once about 10 years ago, down from 7%. I've been aggressively prepaying the mortgage since day one and have a balance of $65,000 left in the mortgage. If I continue prepaying with an extra $425 monthly, I will have the thing paid off in 7 years at age 56. My goal then is to pour all the money I'm now paying towards the mortgage with prepayment, $1,500 monthly, into retirement savings. I'm single and have no other debts besides the mortgage. Does this strategy of continuing to make prepayments make better sense than refinancing and having to spend $3,000 or $4,000 at the closing? And then he also points out that his credit score is 780, so credit is not an issue.
So first of all, I'll say this is a fairly complicated question, and I'm not a financial advisor, so my bottom line recommendation is to go talk to a financial advisor. I will talk to you about a couple of things. First of all, you know, assuming roughly 8 to 9% returns, money will double in 7 years. Will we get those returns in the next 8-9 years? Nobody knows. In fact, most people right now would say no way. That's just something to think about. The other thing is that you want to certainly run the numbers, go on to dinkytown.net and put those numbers in and see how you turn out. You want to also plan. I don't know your age here, but okay, in 7 years you'll be 56. So certainly, you've got plenty of time working and stuff, but you also want to think about what's your earning potential going to be as you go forward, and how much could you make if you invested that, assuming. You can play with your assumptions. You can assume a 4% return, or you can assume a 7%. I choose 8% return over the long term. Play off some scenarios. What happens if you finish paying it off, and then all of a sudden you can't get employed, or something happens? I don't know. But in general, I will tell you that you can search this article I wrote about called "You Have $100 Extra Per Month. Should You Pay Off Your Mortgage Early or Invest?" And that article, basically Consumer Reports did a study and found that you should invest rather than paying it off early because you will actually make more. That's a financial decision. But as we've talked about today, there's a lot more that goes into these decisions than just the numbers. So that's my take on it. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. The question here, something that's left out of the information that we have is what's the status of the retirement funds that are available now. I mean, hopefully at age 49, he's been saving for retirement for quite some time now, because assuming retirement's going to come up pretty soon, maybe 15 years or so, you want to make sure that you're ready for reducing your income to the level that, that you want to experience at that age. If you want to stop working and live off your investments, you're going to have to be ready for that. And that might be a driver for making this decision of how fast you want to pay off the mortgage. On the one hand, you want to have the retirement funds ready to go. And on the other hand, you don't want to have the expense of continuing your mortgage payments while you're in retirement and your income level is lower. So that's something that, you'll have to look at more of your numbers to try to figure out and decide which of those is more important to you.
Yep. Okay. I've got a question. And boy, this is a good one. We talk about beating the credit cards at their own game with cashback rewards and 0% balance transfers. Is it really possible to keep this up for the long term?
Well, I think no. I think that, and this is coming from, I use cashback rewards all the time. I pay almost all my expenses with a cashback rewards credit card. I get my cash back, a couple of times a year. Whenever it gets to be, a couple of $100, I'll request to have the check sent to me. But is it a good idea for everyone? Probably not, because it's actually, and I've tried this myself, in general, people will spend less money when they have to lay out the cash, when they have to take the dollar bills out of their wallet and pay for whatever it is they're buying, they will spend less. That is on average. You can do your own experiment and find out whether it's true for you as long as you're honest with yourself. But on average, that's the way it goes. So the credit card companies are very clever. They make you think you're beating them at their game, but they're still having you spend more. They're still collecting money from the merchants for every transaction you make. They get, you know, a small percentage of what you pay for. And it's psychologically, I mean, it's great. It makes you feel like you're getting this check every few months or once a year or whatever, however your cash back program works. But in reality, it's you could be spending more than you think you're spending. And as far as 0% balance transfers goes, those they're really hard to find now. You know, the banks, the credit card companies, they're having so many of their own financial problems that they can't afford to offer these kind of deals at this time. So while they might last for a while, and you when the credit card companies are willing to be more competitive, they'll offer these great little deals, hopefully to snag you and get you to mess up and get you to forget a payment once, and then they'll jack your rate up, and you'll have to pay that high rate on everything that you've already paid the credit card back. They're very sneaky what they do. So, and I find, you know, especially if it helps to automate your payments to the credit cards to sort of at least knock those down, so there's less of a danger of falling into their traps. But I really think that the credit card companies have the system designed so that you can think that you're beating them, but they're still making money off of you. I mean, okay, so maybe it's a win-win situation. Maybe the credit card's making money and you're getting your cash back. And maybe you're not spending more than you would normally with cash, but you really have to be diligent about it, and it's to do it right, it's going to take probably a little more effort than it may even be worth just to get those cash back checks every once in a while.
I agree 100%. I think these are idiotic, and the people that spend their time trying to beat the credit cards and even rate chase online banks, you are wasting your time. I cannot be clearer than this. Yeah, you can certainly get rewards. And the common argument, and I talk about this on page 34 with rate chasers, and there's another box somewhere else in the book. People are like, well, I'm already going to do it. I might as well get paid $100 a year. Well, first of all, it takes time. Second of all, there are big risks involved, because if you mess up once, you're going to get jacked by the credit card companies. I don't even bother taking the risk, and I know a lot about personal finance, and so do you, Flexo. And then the third thing is, you could be doing something so much better. These are like you're addressing the symptom. You're just playing small little games to make an extra $100 a year. You could be making an extra $5,000, $10,000 a year if you were to spend time focusing on, you know, your credit or focusing on building a business or even cutting costs. And the argument is, well, I can do both. Okay, fine, but at what point do you not? And at what point do you have so many little things on your plate that you can't focus on something big? The other thing is that, like, people do not actually calculate the numbers out, because then they'll quickly realize, holy Christ, I've been wasting like the last 3 years of my life doing rate chasing. So people will be like, oh, Ramit, should I switch from ING Direct to Emigrant Direct? They have 1% higher. I'm like, okay, how much are you going to make? And then their eyes completely glaze over because they haven't calculated that at all. All they go is by the numbers. And I'm like, put the numbers into a calculator before I kill you, please. And what they do is I'm like, do you realize on a $10,000 balance, you would make less than $10 more per month on a $10,000 balance? Is that really worth it to switch from one bank to another? In my opinion, you pick great financial accounts, you stick with them, and get on with your life. Do not waste time down in the trenches. Pick good accounts. Get on with your life. That's it. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, it's just not the most productive way to spend your time chasing rates around and trying to always have all of your money in the highest paying savings account. I mean, high yield savings accounts are great, and everyone should have one. That's probably all you need to say about it. You don't need to go further than that. Everyone should have one. That's it. You don't need to do anything special with it. You can set up some automated transfers, make sure your paycheck is going right into it, so you're earning as much as you can on, you know, as the highest amount of money that you can. But spending so much time trying to research and find those 1% or 0.5% differences in rates and moving your money around from one bank to another, and you're losing time in the transfer, and the banks are keeping they're earning and keeping the interest on the float between the time that the money comes into the bank and the time they actually tell you that your money is in your account. It's just not worth it.
Yeah, it makes no sense. All right, enough of this, or I'm going to start screaming even more. Okay, let's see. You want to take the next one?
Sure. Okay, I've heard advice that calls for moving to an area of the country with a lower cost of living to save money. Does anyone actually do this, and is it good advice?
I don't know. I mean, this is the kind of question that really mystifies me. Like, what kind of answer do you expect? This is very much a personal decision. Are you okay moving to Wyoming? You know, are you going to have a job there? What do you think about raising your kids there? I mean, yes, moving to an area with a lower cost of living probably will save you money if you're earning more, right? But if you're earning more than you're spending. But, I mean, I don't really have much more to add than that. I think this is really a personal decision.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, I read a lot about this specific issue, and there's always someone calling for, the right thing to do is to move, spend less money on the expenses that are there, the lower cost of living, and that's really the right decision without giving any regards to what's important to the person, what you need in a community, in a neighborhood, the things that are important to you. Yes, if you absolutely had to. It's something that you could do, but it's not even, I wouldn't even, I would never give this advice to someone personally.
Because nobody's gonna do it. I mean, right. It's like, why am I, okay, you know, yes, you should also, instead of using a blanket, you should use paper towels. But like,
yeah, I mean, what would be the
this advice? This is not practical for 99% of people.
I agree.
Okay. Next question, how can we limit the effects, even if they're subconscious, that marketing has on us in our role as consumers? What's your take?
Well, I think the first issue with this is just being aware of what's going on. Being aware of the way, the effect that commercials and advertising and just walking through the supermarket, just having a knowledge of the way marketers work is going to put you a little ahead of the game. You're still not going to be immune to it, but at least you understand what's going on and how people are sort of subconsciously convincing you to do things that you probably wouldn't do otherwise. I mean, they talk about you walking down the aisle in the supermarket, they'll put the more expensive products in the line of sight so that when you're looking for something, if you're average height anyway, the products that you'll see first are the ones that are more expensive, and people will be more inclined to pick the products they see first. And just being aware of that fact helps you to step outside just a little bit, just sometimes, and look around you a little bit more, compare prices, and compare, you know, the price per unit, which is always helpful when the supermarkets give you that piece of information. I mean, that's just one example of sort of understanding what's going on around you, and trying to at least a little bit adapt your behavior to accept the fact that this is going to happen. This is the way marketing works, and you're a part of it, and you just have to try to limit it as much as you can without worrying too much about without what's really going on, or else you'll go crazy.
Yeah, I agree that that's part of it, but I think there's a risk in thinking that because you've gotten a little educated about the way marketing works, that it actually will change your behavior. Like, I studied a lot of social psychology, social influence, persuasion, and I still get persuaded all the time. Just knowing about it, just the mere fact that you know about it doesn't mean you're not going to be persuaded. It helps, though. My take is, if you want to limit marketing, the first question is why, right? So sometimes people see marketing as bad. Okay, let me challenge you a little bit. Why? What is your goal? Why do you want to limit the effects of marketing? Talk to me about that. And then what I would say beyond that is decide consciously what you want. Do you want to go on a vacation once a year? Okay, then pay yourself first so that you can do that. If you do that, if you automate your money so it's already going into account, you're actually taking advantage of something I call passive barriers. And you, it'll actually be more difficult for you to cancel those transfers and take the money out because you're going to have to go against your own will. But if you pay yourself first, if you automate your financial infrastructure, I talk about that in chapter 5, then you can decide consciously where you want your money to go. And then it becomes very clear. It's very much, much easier. Instead of like most people who are just like, they have no infrastructure at all. They just randomly spend on whatever. And then at the end of the month, they're like, oh, I guess I spent that much. Here, you've already got your money going to where you decided you want it to go. And you've got guilt-free money that you can use to spend without feeling guilty. But if you decide you want to buy an iPhone because you think it's great and you got marketed to, fine, great, you should do it. But, you know, if you want to limit the effects, I would say the number one thing you can do is automate your money so it's going where you want it to go first.
Yeah, that's great advice.
And we've got one last one. You want to take this
one? Okay, yeah. Let's see. What place does personal ethics have in investment decisions? Okay, there are a lot of varying opinions about this. A lot of people, when making investment decisions, will just focus on the bottom line, and there's nothing wrong with that. And other people will feel that they want to do what they can to have their investments reflect a little bit more about the things that are important to them, just like the sustainability we were talking about earlier, or you know, social causes that are important to them. It's very limiting to do that, and it could be more expensive to do that. But, you know, I think we've talked a lot about this today, and that's, you know, personal choice plays a large role in this. Do you have anything to add?
I think what you said about, I mean, personal choice is definitely one. I think it's up to you. My question for this person is, do you value it? And do you really value it? So you may say, yes, I value personal ethics in investing. I want to do socially responsible investing. Okay, that's a nice opinion. Now let's take it one step further. If I showed you that socially responsible funds on average earn 2% less than index funds, and that would cost you over your lifetime $90,000, would you still value socially responsible investing if it's going to cost you $90,000? And I think the wrinkle here is that I don't know the exact numbers, but do you? And that would be your first step, is saying, okay, I'm going to get educated about socially responsible investing and my other alternatives, and then I'm going to see if I actually value it. And that's kind of what that's the approach I would take with any question, whether it's buying a Mercedes versus a Honda Accord, or doing socially responsible investing versus investing in a regular index fund. You want to kind of understand the alternatives before you make a decision.
Yeah, okay.
Any other things on your mind?
No, I mean, we went through the whole list. I think we touched on a lot of interesting topics.
Maybe we should... if I can ask you to give a plug for your website again, that would be great.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, once again, I call myself Flexo online, and you can read more about me and all the things that I write about at consumerismcommentary.com.
Great. And this is Ramith Sethi from I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Really glad that you were able to come on, and can't wait to do this again.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I like this.
Thanks so much.